died, he accepted neither loss nor death easily. He'd told her instead of summer days of sunshine and heather, of the icy pleasure of a cool loch on a hot day, of tales of his 7 bonny sisters and their endless quests for husbands of whom he would approve. At last, the panicked expression had receded from her eyes. She was no willy-nilly peahen. In fact, by the hour, his estimation of her continued to rise. She was a fascinating woman.
"And not for you,"
the tatters of his humanity warned. Nay, not for him, he agreed with those tatters. Glad they were tatters, and not capable of mounting a compelling argument. For he would have her. Despite the feeble protests of his honor, he was going to seduce her the moment he got her somewhere safe. He'd known since the night she'd licked him that he was going to make her his woman. Consequences be damned. Why not? He already was. Before disposing of the assassin's body, he'd searched the dead woman thoroughly. She'd carried nothing but weapons. He'd relieved her of a knife and 2 guns, which were now concealed in his boots. The woman had not meant to kill his Jessica. Had she would have used one of the guns. He knew a great deal about modern weapons. They fascinated him. He'd long itched to get his hands on a gun and test its capabilities. There was a 9th-century warrior in him that would never lose his love of a good battle and fine armament. No. The assassin had intended to subdue his woman, not kill her. 'Twas the why of the needle, not the blade or the bullet. The realization had given birth to a whole new wellspring of hatred for his longtime jailer. Somehow, Lucan had learned of Jessica St. James and wanted her alive. From time to time, Lucan had entertained himself with a woman before the dark glass, uncaring if she saw or heard Kian, because the woman didn't survive to tell of it anyway. Lucan liked to break things. He always had. The harder it was to break, the more he enjoyed it. But those were dark thoughts. Thoughts from a time that would never be again, for he would never again be owned by Lucan Trevane. Never again be forced to hang on that bastard's wall and watch an innocent woman sexually brutalized and murdered. No matter the price of vengeance, of freedom. He'd come to terms with that price long ago.
"Don't you want to know what I did?"
she was saying.
I do.
His gaze fixed on her profile. She nibbled her lower lip a moment, and it made him abruptly rock hard at the mere thought of her luscious mouth nibbling on him.
"I used a credit card."
She sounded disgusted with herself.
"I know in books and movies the bad guys always track you by your credit or ATM transactions, but I thought that was just an exaggeration cultivated by the media to facilitate plot momentum, that if it could really be done, it would take time, like days or a week."
She frowned up at him.
"I mean, come on, how powerful is this Lucan guy that he can find out where I've used my credit card within hours of my using it?"
He firmly corralled his lustful thoughts. He needed to understand such matters. They were imperative to his ability to keep her alive and safe from harm.
"Explain to me about credit cards, lass."
He'd once seen an advertisement on television for such a thing, where club-wielding painted warriors had poured down in a bloodthirsty horde on someone who'd chosen the wrong card. But he couldn't begin to see how using such a thing had betrayed them. When she'd clarified its purpose and explained the records generated by the use of it, he snorted. Now he understood how Lucan had found them so quickly. Bloody hell, was there no such thing as privacy left in her world? Everything was connected to everything else by those computers of hers. All a man did and said was a matter of public or semi-public record, which was appalling to a mountain man who liked to keep his matters his own.
"He's that powerful, lass. You may not use such things again. Have you no other form of coin?"
"Not enough to get us out of the country, which is what I'm beginning to think we need to do,"
she said gloomily.
Aye, she had the right of that.
The fact that he'd not even known she'd done something that could be traced, revealing them as clearly as an X on a map, because he'd not understood what a credit card was, meant he couldn't possibly hope to contain their exposure.
Not here, anyway. Her 21st century world had too many variables beyond his comprehension for him to control, which meant he had to take her back in time.
Ah, nay, not literally, not through the Bandricade, the stones of the White Bridge that the Keltar guarded. Even he gave credence to the legend of the Draugr, having no wish to be possessed by the 13 evil ancients. But figuratively, that he could do. If he could get her deep enough into the highlands, then he could live with her for the next 19 days by 9th-century means. Means untraceable by modern methods. He could shelter her in caves, warm her with his body, hunt for food, and feed her with his hands. In the old ways, time-honored ways in which a man had once seen to the needs of his woman. All they had to do was somehow get across an ocean, quickly and without leaving a trace. Would Lucan look for him there? Certainly, once he realized he was no longer in Chicago. Lucan knew him, nigh as well as he knew Lucan. But there, in the wilderness, Kian would have more of an advantage. Even in the 9th century, Lucan had never been an outdoorsman, eschewing physical exertion in lieu of creature comforts. Ach, aye, Kian would have the edge in his hills.
"Tell me everything you know about modern travel," he commanded. "Tell me about your airplanes, where they go, how often they go, where one may procure one, and how. Tell me in the greatest detail you can. Give me a bird's-eye view, lass. I need ken it all, even the most minuscule facts you might deem unimportant. I'm a 9th-century man, lass. Teach me as one."
Near noon, Jessie demanded they stop for food. She was starving. He might not need to eat, being immortal or whatever he was, but she sure did. The first time she'd ordered room service, it hadn't come. The second time, the dishes had gotten splattered by blood. Aside from a power bar and a bag of peanuts she'd found in her backpack, she'd had nothing else to eat in the past 36 hours. Since leaving Chicago, Kian had grilled her intensively about everything from transportation to computers, to accommodations to monetary transactions. After listening for a short time, he'd told her that they dare not leave the country from O'Hare or Midway, that if Lucan had men watching for them anywhere, it would be at the 2 local airports. Jessie still couldn't quite believe that they were actually going to try to leave the country, and had no idea how he thought they were going to pull it off. He'd told her to drive them to the next nearest airport. She didn't know if Indianapolis really was the next nearest, but it was the only other airport she'd been able to figure out how to get to from a map. They stopped to eat just east of Lafayette, Indiana, about 45 minutes up I-65 from the airport. The smell of deep-fried chicken and fries made her mouth water the moment they stepped inside Chick-fil-A. She always felt like she was doing cows a favor when she ate there. She loved those silly billboards along the highways with their Eat More Chicken Cow campaign. From New Diet Craze, Low Cow, to Eat Chicken, Cuddle Cows, the ads sporting black and white spotted cows clutching poorly pinned placards promoting chicken consumption made her laugh out loud every time she drove past one.
"I will procure food, and we'll dine in the car," he'd insisted. "We must continue moving."
She could just imagine how he planned to procure food. He'd probably leave the entire restaurant standing frozen until,
well, after we are away from here.
"If I eat while driving," she disagreed, "I'll wreck. If I wreck, the mirror will probably break." Her legs were stiff. She had to pee, and she was getting grumpy. "What would happen to you then?" He'd looked stricken.
"We'll dine within."
She'd ordered 6 baskets of chicken fingers and wedges of crinkly fries, and now, perched at a brightly colored yellow and white table, was contentedly making headway into her 2nd basket. He was halfway through his 3rd.
"These resemble no chicken fingers I've ever seen, lass, and I saw a fair amount of chickens in my day. There was this wench in the stables with the most remarkable... Well, never mind that. You must grow fowl considerably larger now. I shudder to ponder the size of their beaks."
"They're not really chicken fingers,"
she hastened to explain, not caring for the imagery at all, as she dipped one into a tub of spicy barbecue sauce and snapped off a bite. She was going to stop there, she really was, but her treacherous lips had other ideas.
Most remarkable what?
'Tis of no import, lass.
He devoured another chicken finger in two bites.
Then why did you bring it up?
She said stiffly.
I put it to rest, too, lass.
There went two more fingers.
No, you didn't. You left it hanging. Now it's hanging out there. I hate things hanging out there. Fix it. Remarkable what?
He dipped a potato wedge into ketchup and made short work of it.
Chickens, lass. She had remarkable chickens. What did you think I meant?
Jessie's nostrils flared. She glared at him a moment, then looked away. Why did she even care? So maybe the 9th century bimbo had had remarkable eyes or legs or something. No way her breasts were better. At that thought, she shrugged her jean jacket off her shoulders and sat up straighter. And so what, anyway? The bimbo had been dead for 11 centuries. The only thing remarkable about her now was that anyone even remembered her at all.
Back to the chickens, lass. If they're not fingers, why are they named thusly?
It's just a catchphrase, she said irritably, snapping off another bite. Something some marketing guy came up with to make them more appealing.
Your century finds the notion of eating fingers of chickens appealing. What of their toes?
She took a sip of Coke. The chicken was suddenly dry as sawdust on her tongue.
I don't think anybody who orders them thinks for even a minute about fingers or toes any more than they think about little pink chicken nipples when they're eating chicken breasts.
She broke off, eyes narrowing. His head was canted down, his hair shielding his face, but she could plainly see his shoulders shaking with silent laughter. The Neanderthal was yanking her chain, and she'd fallen for every bit of it. After a moment, she shook her head and snorted. He'd been poking fun not only at her century, but himself in a dry, subtle way. And she'd bought right into the stereotype he'd been feeding her. Me, big and stupid, archaic He-Man. Her snort became a snicker, her snicker a laugh. He glanced up sharply, his dark amber gaze fixing on her face.
I hoped to make you laugh, he said softly. I've not seen much in the way of happiness in your eyes since we've crossed paths.
No, I don't suppose you have, she agreed. It's been a bit grim.
They shared a companionable silence for a moment, across the table in Chick-fil-A.
So was it really her chickens that were remarkable?
Kian shook his head.
Nay, lass.
She scowled.
What then? Come on, you're the one who brought her up.
He flashed her a devilish grin.
There was no wench in the stables, Jessica. I but wondered if you'd care.
Two could push for information, she thought mulishly a short time later, as they hastened over soggy, slippery autumn leaves on their brisk walk across the parking lot toward her car. The October breeze ruffling her short, dark hair held the promise of the long, cold Midwestern winter to come. The chilly drizzle that had been falling steadily since they'd left Chicago had eased to a mist, but the sky was still leaden with thunderheads, threatening worse rain ahead. She fluffed her short curls back from her face and tugged her jean jacket closer. In contrast to the cool climb, her temper was hot. She was steamed and humiliated that he'd gotten a rise out of her. She hardly knew the man, and she'd felt a vicious stab of jealousy over him. Twice. In a matter of hours. That wasn't like her at all, and the fact that she hardly knew the man was really beginning to bother her. She'd accepted that she was going to have to entrust herself to him to survive, but by God she wanted to know more about the man that she was entrusting herself to. Who and what was Kian McKelter? And who and what was this Lucan Trevane person who wanted her dead just because she'd seen his blasted artifact? They were both clearly more than mere men. As they approached the car, Jessie stopped at the driver's side door and scowled across the roof at him. He arched an inquiring brow.
I'm not going any farther until you answer a few of my questions.
Jessica.
Don't Jessica me, she said peevishly. 5 minutes is all I'm asking of you. Surely 5 minutes won't get us killed. What are you, Kian?
He assessed her a long moment, then shrugged one powerful shoulder.
I'm a druid, lass.
A druid?
She blinked.
You mean as in one of those white-robe-wearing, mistletoe-loving guys that thought they could communicate with the other world by performing human sacrifices?
In her area of specialization, she was constantly encountering references to the mysterious, much maligned priesthood. The famous Lindo Man, a late Iron Age body found preserved in a Cheshire bog by peat cutters in 1984, evidenced signs of ritual murder, and with mistletoe pollen in his stomach, there had been much speculation about his possible link with druids. He winced.
Ouch. Is that how the world thinks of us now?
Pretty much. Are you telling me druids were actually magicians of some kind? Like Merlin or something?
He glanced guardedly around the parking lot.
Jessica, there's magic all around you. People dinna ken it because those who possess it take every precaution to conceal it. Magic has always been, and will always be.
Her eyes narrowed.
So this Lucan guy is also a druid?
He was once a druid. He became a dark sorcerer.
A week ago she would have laughed herself silly at anyone who'd claimed such things existed. She would have asked them about lions and tigers and bears and ruby slippers with built-in teleportation devices. Now, resting her elbows on the wet roof of her car, propping her chin on her hands, she only sighed and said,
"Okay, so what's the difference?"
"A druid is born with magic in his blood. A dark sorcerer's magic is acquired via rigorous study and apprenticeship to black magics, enhanced by rituals and spells. A druid respects the innate nature of things and permits the universe its pattern. A dark sorcerer perverts the nature of things to his own aims, changing the universe's pattern without thought to ramifications. A druid seeks knowledge to heal and nurture. A sorcerer seeks dangerous alchemy to transform and control. A druid-turned-dark sorcerer is far more powerful than either a mere sorcerer or a mere druid."
"Well, if he's a druid-turned-dark sorcerer, and you're just a druid, and a druid-turned-dark sorcerer is so much more powerful, then just how do you plan to defeat..." "Oh, criminy shit!"
Understanding belatedly dawning, she backpedaled away from him, butting up against the rain-slicked side of the car parked parallel to hers.
"I can be so dense sometimes," she breathed. "Because you're one of the bad guys, too, aren't you? You turned dark sorcerer, too, didn't you? It's the only way it makes sense."
His whiskey eyes narrowed.
"Get in the car, Jessica,"
he said softly. She shook her head.
"Uh-uh. No way. I'm not done yet. You still haven't told me about that commanding thing you do. When you tell people to do things and they just do it. What is that, anyway?"
A muscle in his jaw worked, and he regarded her a long, silent moment. Then,
"'Tis the druid art of voice. Some call it the voice of power."
He saw no need to tell her that others called it the voice of death, if the druid was powerful enough. And he was. Though he'd not known he could kill with his tongue until it had been too late, and he'd already killed with his tongue.
"'Tis a spell of compulsion, lass. Now, get in the car, the storm worsens."
As if to support his words, the rain chose that moment to turn into a steady, soaking drizzle, and a boom of thunder crashed overhead. But Jessie wasn't going to let an inconvenient storm interrupt her now. She had a small storm of her own brewing. This compelling thing bothered her. A lot.
"Can you make people do things they don't want to do? Like bad things that would seriously go against their will? Are they even aware of it when you're doing it to them? Do they remember when it's over?"
she demanded. The muscle leapt in his jaw again.
Get in the car, Jessica. I'm trying to keep you alive,
he said coolly.
What if I refuse?
She said just as coolly.
Will you force me into the car? Compel me into it? Now that I think about it, I'm surprised you haven't already tried to use this voice of yours on me. Why bother being nice to anyone when you could just command anything you want? Jeez, you wouldn't even have to seduce a woman. You could just order her to...
She broke off abruptly, eyes widening.
Get in the car, Jessica.
Oh, God, you did try it on me,
she exclaimed.
You tried it the second I set you free. You tried to make me kiss you and show you my breasts, didn't you?
His dark, chiseled face was a fortress. If he felt any emotion at all, it was completely concealed. Gaze remote, he inclined his head a single time. Behind him, lightning flashed, brilliant and jagged against the grim, steely Indiana sky. A short, caustic laugh escaped her.
And it didn't work, did it? For some reason, it doesn't work on me at all, does it?
He gave a single shake of his head.
None of my magic does.
Jessie stared at him, struggling to take in this new information that put such a different slant on the way she'd so naively believed things to be. She'd been walking around thinking that the good guy was keeping her safe from the bad guy, only to find out that there were no good guys in Jessie St. James's world, just bad and badder. She wanted to know exactly how bad.
So, how far would you have taken it, Mr. Poor Me, I'm Trapped in a Mirror, Dark Sorcerer? If it had worked, if I'd removed my woolen and shown you my breasts, how far would you have pushed?
How the bloody hell far do you think?
I'm asking you, how far?
She demanded.
I haven't fucked in 1133 years, Jessica,
he said flatly.
I am a man.
How far?
She repeated frostily.
All the way, woman, all the friggin' way. Now get in the damned car.
A flash of lightning, followed by a booming thunderclap, punctuated his final words, as if nature herself conspired with him. Jessie stared at him in silence, rain dripping down her face, splattering on her chest, pondering her options, being brutally honest with herself. She could walk away now, try it on her own, see if she could manage to disappear for the next 19 days. She was being hunted by a bona fide 9th-century sorcerer who wanted her dead. She was being kept alive by another bona fide 9th-century sorcerer who wanted to have sex with her and was willing to use magic to score. Her life or her virtue? It bore considering that it was a virtue she'd very nearly given him of her own accord. Granted, she'd hardly been in her right mind at the time, but still. She got in the damned car. Chapter 13. They were flying at a cruising altitude of 36,000 feet above the Atlantic Ocean when the dark glass reclaimed him. At least they hadn't been about to have sex this time, so Jessie wasn't left with a bad case of hostile hormones and aghast at herself for yet another appalling lapse in moral fiber. She glanced hastily around when he vanished and caught several other passengers doing double takes. It didn't surprise her to discover other people were looking straight at him when he disappeared. He was just that kind of man, the kind people watched. Some because they wondered what it would be like to have sex with such a gorgeous, dangerous-looking hunk of testosterone, the category she was in. Others because they were concerned about their purses, wallets, or lives, the category she was in. None of the onlookers said a word. Assuming any of them believed it had genuinely happened, not one of them appeared in any hurry to talk about it. She smothered a dry laugh.
Been there, done that. Thought I was going nuts, too, the first few times I saw him,
she thought. Tugging the worn blue airline blanket up to her chin, she pretended nothing was amiss, that she'd boarded alone and been alone all this time.
She'd been braced for him to disappear. He'd told her before they embarked that the dark glass would no doubt reclaim him long before they got to Scotland. Scotland? Criminy, she was on her way out of the country. Life as she'd known it, work, school, and all her tidily scheduled plans, were slipping away from her at the astonishing rate of 565 miles per hour. She'd not believed they were going to be able to pull it off until they'd arrived at the Indianapolis airport, and he'd proceeded to give her a mind-boggling display of his formidable talents. He'd used his voice to coerce airport employees to crate and ship the mirror to Edinburgh. Unwilling to generate any records of their passage, he'd bypassed procuring tickets and instead persuaded their way through security, past armed officers. There'd not been a direct flight available to Scotland, and he'd refused to go through London, as it would take them too close to Lucan for his comfort. So he'd voiced them onto a Boeing 747 bound first for Paris, showing only his palm as necessary documentation, accompanied by terse commands. She'd watched in abject amazement. Quite simply, anything the man said, people believed and obeyed. Mutely, docilely, blankly. He'd used a few forgetting commands as well, though he'd told her they were tricky things, and he was employing mild ones only to buy them all the time possible. He'd told her that a true forgetting spell took much time and was risky, as the mind endeavored to retain the imprints it bore, and stripping away one memory frequently damaged many others. It was a damage he was clearly reluctant to be the cause of, which she found interesting for a druid turned dark sorcerer. By the time they'd boarded and dropped into emergency exit seats, two cooing female flight attendants had much too sweetly for her taste volunteered to rearrange things so the 6.5-foot sexy Scotsman could stretch out his legs a bit. Grr. Jessie'd had a pretty darn good idea why his talents didn't work on her. She'd actually felt it trying to work on her. Each time he'd laid the compulsion on thick, her head had itched inside, just above the metal plate splicing her skull together, the same way it had when she'd first freed him, and he'd been attempting to compel her. It felt as if his commands were buzzing up against her metal plate, making it vibrate beneath her skin. She couldn't begin to comprehend the mechanics of it. She just knew it somehow shielded her from his magic. Thank heavens! For the first time in her life, she was grateful she'd taken that horrendous skull-splitting fall.
"All the way, woman,"
he'd said back in the rainy parking lot of Chick-fil-A, meaning he would have used voice on her to have sex with her. It had perturbed her, deeply, until she'd realized he was lying. Maybe he believed he would have pushed her all the way, but she didn't. She judged people by their actions, not their words, and his actions just didn't support his words. Big bark. Little bite. Even his commands to get them on board the plane had been tempered. He'd wielded the least coercion necessary to accomplish their goals. Bottom line was, any man who would have used magic to have sex with her against her will would simply have changed tactics when magic had failed and raped her with his brutally superior strength, especially after 11 centuries of enforced celibacy. Kian was nearly 6 feet 6 inches of pure muscle. He'd had multiple opportunities to do anything he wanted to her, and he'd not harmed her in any way. Tucking her legs up, she snuggled deeper into the blanket. The lights were low. It had been yet another long day, and the steady hum of the engines was lulling her to sleep. She closed her eyes, pondering the power he had, the druid art of voice, he'd called it, trying to imagine what it would be like to have the ability to make anyone do anything you wanted them to do, merely by telling them to do it. She was blown away by the possibilities, and by the awesome responsibility. Druid turned dark sorcerer? She wasn't so sure she believed that. Oh, maybe a little bad, but the man wasn't evil. In fact, he seemed a near paragon of restraint, in light of all he was probably capable of doing. She yawned, wondering how young he'd been when he'd realized such a thing was within his means. Voice meant consummate power, consummate freedom. It meant being able to live with absolute impunity, no excuses, no apologies necessary. If it were her gift, she thought drowsily, she could hop on a plane any time she wanted, fly to England, and make them let her pet Stonehenge. Or she could go to Ireland and visit the museums and touch things, take things home with her for heaven's sake. Or, she mused dreamily, she could go to a bank, make them give her millions of dollars, buy herself houses in 10 different countries, and spend her life playing on pristine white beaches in the sun. Or, the heck with money, she could just go to those countries and make people give their houses to her. She wondered how many people voice could control at any one time, and for how long. Surely there were limits. Still, what a ridiculous amount of power, she murmured on a sleepy sigh. The world would, quite literally, be one's playground. Still, even with it, he'd somehow gotten trapped in a mirror for centuries on end. Strong warrior's body, yet gentle hands. Formidably endowed with magic, yet trapped. What an enigma he was. It occurred to her, as she drifted off to sleep, that it should probably worry her a lot that, even in the middle of the utter chaos her life had become, he was an enigma she was greatly looking forward to deciphering. An eit achwil du hoi is an a haverfas du hoisahu. Your feet will bring you to where your heart is. Old Scots saying. Part 2. Scotland. Chapter 14. The God-Awful Hour of 3 a.m. Edinburgh Airport. Sunday, October 15th.
No, I don't have a claim ticket,
Jessie told the woman behind the desk for the fifth time, beyond exasperated.
I keep telling you that, but I can describe it exactly, every tiny little detail, both crate and contents. Now how could I possibly know that such a crate even existed, not to mention what was inside it, unless it was mine? And I keep telling you, the woman huffed, that nothing gets claimed without a claim ticket, young lady. You don't understand. I need that crate,
Jessie said urgently.
I understand perfectly,
the 50-something ash blonde replied, without a flicker of emotion on her Botox-smoothed face, but with an unmistakable sneer in her voice.
You want to collect something for which you have no claim ticket. How would you feel if I permitted someone else to claim your package with no claim ticket? How could we hope to control our packages at all if we permitted such unauthorized claimings to occur? That's why, young lady, we give claim tickets in the first place. One ticket retrieves one corresponding package. You may file a missing claim ticket claim, if you wish. How long will it take me to get my package if I file a missing claim ticket claim? Processing a missing claim ticket claim can take several weeks to several months.
Jessie was not pessimistic by nature, but she could have sworn a note of smug satisfaction had just entered the woman's voice, and she suddenly had no doubt any claim she filed would lean toward the several months mark. For whatever reason, the woman didn't like her and didn't want to help her. And without the mirror, Jessie was doomed. She had a whopping $42.17 in her purse. Oh, sure, she had a credit card, but the moment she used it, Lucan would know exactly where she was. She needed the bottomless bank account of Kian McKelter's deep, sexy, magical voice. One way or another, she had to get the mirror back, and it was pretty clear that this woman had no intention of facilitating things. Some people were problem-solvers, and some people were problem-compounders. This woman was a compounder, with a capital C. Jessie muttered a nearly inaudible thank you and turned hurriedly away before she said something she'd regret. Sighing, she shifted her backpack to her other sore shoulder, trudged back down the long hallway, out into the main part of the airport, and slumped wearily into a hard plastic chair. She glanced at her watch, slipped it from her wrist, and moved the hour hand forward 6 hours. It was a little after 9 in the morning, Edinburgh time.
Well, she consoled herself, the bright side of things is that he'll definitely be able to come out now, if I can just get to him.
It had been over 24 hours in both time zones since he'd last been free, and drat it all, she actually missed the domineering barbarian. Missed his annoying testosterone overload, missed knowing that any minute now he might give her one of those kisses that vacuumed her brain out through her ear and turned her into a vapid little sex kitten. Leaning back in the torture chamber of a chair, she rubbed her eyes and took a deep breath.
Flight 412 leaving Edinburgh for London will depart.
A woman's lilting voice spoke brightly from the speaker above her. Leaving Edinburgh. She was in Scotland. The fabulous 5,000-year-old stone furniture of Scarabray was near. The incredible Rosslyn Chapel was a mere 8 miles from Edinburgh. The ruins of Dunatar and countless other ancient treasures loomed just beyond the airport doors. And she was beginning to think she might never make it that far. Her connecting flight from Paris had landed 5 hours ago, and she'd been trying to get her hands on the mirror ever since. It had taken her nearly an hour just to find the idiotic special items claim pickup office. It hadn't been anywhere near baggage, as she'd expected, but down a long hallway, tucked back in the rear of the airport, accessible only through a window that opened onto a long counter built into the wall. It had been so deserted that she'd not believed she was in the right place, until she'd glimpsed the tiny handwritten sign perched on the corner of the desk. It seemed almost as if they wanted to keep the unclaimed items. Maybe, she thought cynically, they auctioned them off to employees or something when their time was up. There wasn't even an exterior door into the office. Apparently staff gained access some other way.
If there's no name on the crate, where will it go when it arrives in Edinburgh?
Kian had asked, prior to compelling the airline employees to crate and ship it.
It would have to go to unclaimed baggage.
She couldn't imagine it going anywhere else. Without a name or a return shipping address, they certainly couldn't send it back. She'd learned that lesson herself, trying to get rid of the crate. She also knew that airports were required to hold items, even unmarked ones, for a certain number of days. She'd lost her luggage once, between home in Maine and school in Chicago, and by the time it had resurfaced, there'd not been a single identifying tag on it.
If you go to this unclaimed baggage place and can identify it, will they give it to you?
Kian had pressed.
I don't know,
she'd replied.
We'll have to take the chance. I'll not leave any records of our travel. If you can but get into the same room with my crate and say the spell, I can break free and use voice to get us out of there. Jessica, lass, I'm sorry. 'Tis not a foolproof plan. You'll have to improvise.
Improvisation hadn't seemed such a daunting task back in Indianapolis. But then she'd been feeling weirdly invincible walking along beside him, and they'd both mistakenly thought the crate would be somewhere that she could see it, if not actually collect it. She groaned, wishing she had a single ounce of Kian's incredible powers of voice to use on Ms. Erase My Face at the Special Items Claim Desk. Then again, she mused. She wasn't entirely certain she would want that kind of power, if given the opportunity. It would certainly be a test of just how good a person really was deep down. Shaking her head, she pushed to her feet. She would kill a bit of time grabbing a cup of coffee and a croissant. Then she would trudge back down the long, silent corridor and try again. Maybe by then the woman would be on break, and somebody else would be working. The woman was not only not on break by the time Jessie got back to the special items pickup window, she got an expression when she saw Jessie walking toward the desk again. It was hard to pick up on it, unnoticeable as it was from more than a few feet away. But if Jessie peered really hard, she could see the faintest pucker of a muscle trying to contract between the woman's brows. Not good.
"Could you just bring it out here and let me see it?"
Jessie asked the woman.
"Just let me make sure it's okay and it's really here. Then I swear I'll go away and leave you alone. I'll fill out your forms and go through the red tape. Just let me make sure it actually got here. I'm worried about it. Please, could I please just see it?"
"There are no exceptions,"
the woman said with a sniff.
"But I..." "Which word didn't you understand? It must have been the no. You are so typical. People like you always think they should be exceptions."
Jessie blinked.
people like me?"
she echoed, stymied as to just what kind of people this woman thought she was.
"Yes, people like you."
The woman's gaze dropped to her breasts.
"I'm sure you've gotten used to manipulating men to get them to do whatever you want, but you can't manipulate me. And no men work this desk, young lady, so don't even think about trying to come back at another time. I've already warned my co-workers about you. No one is going to fall for your shenanigans. You're going to have to follow the rules for a change, little missy, just like everyone else."
Jessie blinked, rendered speechless by the unfair attack. She'd never used her looks to get anywhere in life, and if they'd ever helped her, she'd certainly not been aware of it. Without another word, Stoneface inclined her pinched nose, moved away from the window, and made a big show of dismissing her. After a moment, she began typing busily away at a computer terminal with lethal-looking orange nails. Jessie swallowed a little growl.
"Focus," she told herself, "and not on Stoneface's unwarranted nastiness. She is not your problem. Getting the mirror back is."
Backing up a few steps, she scanned the counter. The mirror had to be nearby. It just had to. If one came to this window to claim special items, logic dictated the items would be stored close at hand for the purpose of expediency. One would present their ticket, and the item would be brought to the counter, which seemed to imply that the items had to be somewhere behind the counter. She pushed up on tiptoes and glanced over the desk. Stoneface was still making a big show of ignoring her, which was just fine with Jessie. There were no crates stacked back there that she could see, and the little room, which was about 20 feet wide and maybe 10 feet deep, didn't look as if it was large enough for more than 3 or 4 employees to stand lined up at the desk. On the left wall hung a gaudily framed, turbulent seascape, adjacent to a phone marked security. The rear wall was dotted by small paintings of ships at sea, interspersed with various official-looking certificates in utilitarian black frames. Aha! There! On the right wall, a half-opened door revealed a long, brightly lit corridor stretching off into the distance.
"My crate is down that hallway, isn't it?"
Jessie exclaimed. She didn't expect an answer from the woman. She knew she'd have to get it from her face. The woman glanced up, the hint of a muscle contracting between her brows. Yes, Kian was close, improvisably close.
"I can do this. I can do this. I know I can," she told herself.
She stared down at the floor for a few seconds, steeling her nerve. Then she turned and began walking away from the counter. Behind her, the woman muttered snidely,
"About time, and good riddance to you, you spoiled little—"
The rest of it was muttered too low for Jessie to hear, but she didn't need to. She'd already picked up on the general gist of it.
"Oh, you are going to be so surprised,"
she thought just as snidely. She didn't mind people getting upset with her when she'd done something to deserve it, but she'd not done a thing to earn this woman's animosity, other than being young and curvy, and she couldn't help being either of those things. It wasn't as if either of those things had ever gotten her anywhere in her life. Hard work had. Boobs certainly hadn't. In fact, were she pushed to divvy up percentages, she'd attribute 90% to aggravation and 10% to pleasure. Wiggling her shoulders to make sure her backpack was snug enough, she glanced behind her, assessed the distance to and the height of the counter, and took a deep, fortifying breath. Then she whirled around, took a running leap, and catapulted herself into the air. She managed to pump up more speed with her short dash than she actually needed, and upon clearing the exterior wall of the counter, she couldn't check her forward momentum. Skidding pell-mell over the veneered surface on her hands and knees, she crashed to the floor, taking down 2 mainframes and a stack of manuals with her. She hit the floor so hard it made her teeth clack together.
"Go!" the woman shrieked. "Out! Out! Out! You are not allowed back here! Only airport employees are permitted behind the desk!"
Jessie didn't waste breath replying. Scrambling to her feet, she clambered over monitors and manuals and pushed through the half-opened door. Her heart was pounding and adrenaline was rushing through her veins, making her feel shaky, yet intensely, aggressively focused. It was no wonder some people got addicted to adrenaline rushes.
"I'm calling security!"
the woman screeched after her, snatching the phone from the wall.
"You just do that,"
Jessie dropped her voice, but despite her best efforts, "Bitch!" didn't come out quite as sotto voce as she'd intended. Oops. Darn it, now she was going to have to outrun security, too. But the woman's nastiness worked to her advantage this time. Apparently, Stoneface had been secretly itching to take matters into her own hands, and Jessie's expletive was just enough to push her over the edge. Slapping the phone back on the wall, Stoneface shot through the door after her.
"I don't need security. I can deal with you myself, you brazen little hussy!"
Sharp orange talons closed on the fabric of Jessie's backpack, yanking her to a halt.
"You are not going back there!"
Jessie dug in her heels, scanning the corridor. It was roughly 100 yards long, with a maze of hallways branching off it, and doors dotting both the left and right sides. At the far end of the corridor, two tall steel doors gleamed, the kind that looked like they might open onto a warehouse. Near those doors, several carts and a small front loader waited. That would be where the mirror was, then, through those double doors. She needed it. It was non-negotiable. And this red-tape-wielding, small, mean-souled twit clutching a fistful of her backpack was all that was standing between her and the small matter of her continued survival. Her life depended on that crate, and there was no other way she could get to it. She twisted her shoulders, yanking her backpack from the woman's grasp. When it tumbled down her arm, she caught the straps of it in her hand. Bracing herself, she gulped yet another fortifying breath. She was going to need this one. Muttering a silent prayer that it would work and not actually injure the woman beyond a temporary black eye, she swung around and coshed the woman in the side of the head with her 38-pound Krispy Kreme-earning backpack. Much to her relief, she wasn't entirely certain about doing it twice, no matter how nasty the witch was. Stoneface's eyes glazed. She swayed woozily and sank limply to the floor. Glancing hastily around, Jessie spied a door labeled Supplies down the hall. Grabbing the woman's feet, she hooked her ankles beneath her armpits and hurriedly slid her down the polished tile floor. It took her a few moments to wedge her in with all the brooms and mops and cleaning supplies, but she managed it. Closing the door, she examined the handle. There was no way to lock it. That sucked. And meant she had to hurry. She couldn't imagine the woman would stay out for very long. Heart pounding, Jessie dashed off for the double doors and Kian. Lucan slammed his fist through the silk-papered plaster wall of his study. Again. And a third time. Blood beaded swiftly across his shredded knuckles and just as swiftly disappeared. The skin healed, not shiny and pink, but it healed. He turned back toward his desk, glanced up at the offending darker rectangular spot on the wall, and snarled at the speakerphone.
"Tell me again exactly what they said, in detail."
"None of them recalled many details, Mr. Trevain, sir,"
Hans replied from the receiver.
"Just that they saw a tall, tattooed man with dark braids carrying a large gold-framed mirror, accompanied by a young, attractive woman, walking through the Sheraton's lobby on Friday morning. If the two of them stayed at the hotel, all records have been erased. One of the guest rooms was found with fresh human blood on the carpet, drapes, and furniture. But the hotel has no record of having assigned that room to anyone for several nights, and no body has been found."
Son of a bitch, the worst was true. Eve was most certainly dead, and the Highlander was being aided and abetted by the St. James woman. They'd united efforts against him, and he had less than 17 days to find them.
"Were you able to learn where they went from there?"
"No, Mr. Trevain, sir. We've not been able to ascertain that. We're working on it. Do you have any ideas, sir?"
Lucan rubbed his jaw. Where would Kian McKelter go now that he had someone beyond the glass who was willing to help him get there? That was the determining factor, after all. The rules of their little game had changed dramatically. Not once in 1,000 years had Lucan ever imagined that such an improbable sequence of events might ever come to pass, that something might shatter his unbreakable wards, that he might be out of the country at the time, that a thief might break into his home and steal the glass, that the glass might end up in the hands of someone willing to help the Keltar.
It reeked of preposterous synchronicity. Nevertheless, it had happened. Where would the Keltar go? There was no doubt in Lucan's mind. Home to his highlands, of course. The mountain man would move heaven and earth to walk on Scots soil again, especially now. It had been a long time since Lucan had visited the hills above Inverness. For countless generations, after he'd imprisoned Cian in the Dark Glass, he'd kept close tabs on the Keltar bloodline. He'd wanted to be certain Cian's mother had done as she'd sworn in exchange for the continued health and well-being of her 7 precious daughters, sealed away all Keltar lore from future generations, and stricken her son's name from all Keltar annals, thereby preventing any future Keltar from nursing a blood grudge and trying to free their ancestor. But by the early 1400s, when his sources had confirmed that the MacKeltar, to the last man, woman, and child, believed the legendary Cian nothing more than a myth, Lucan had quit watching and quit caring. He'd turned his attentions elsewhere, immersed himself in the building of his empire and his search for the remaining Dark Hallows. Time and success had made him careless. He'd not been challenged in so long that complacency had dulled his edge. Christ! 17 days! It was unthinkable. He was so near to achieving his goals, he couldn't afford these idiotic distractions. Scotland, Hans. Lucan clipped at the phone. Search Inverness. I suspect he'll bypass civilization and head for the hills. Find out if any MacKeltar still live in the area. And let it be known I'm offering 5 million to whomever gets me that mirror. 10 for the mirror and the woman. However, I must be informed the instant the mirror is located and kept constantly apprised of its whereabouts. There's another 10 million in it for you, Hans, if you bring this to successful completion within a week.
Yes, sir. Mr. Trevane, sir. I'll let the others know, sir. I'll get every man on it. I'll take care of this for you. You have my personal guarantee, sir.
Lucan stared into space for a long time after he terminated the call. What was 25 million to him? Nothing. He'd wearied of wealth centuries ago. He wanted what he'd always wanted. More power. He was so close to the culmination of all his dreams, a hair's breadth away from finally possessing the Unseelie Dark Book. From finally being the greatest sorcerer the world had ever known, both mortal and fey. He should have seen these complications coming. He knew that when a man poised on the brink of achieving true greatness, the world tested him. It had happened to him before. It would happen again. He should have been better prepared this time. He would be, in the future. He, Lucan Merthyn Trevane, fathered by an unknown druid on a whore of a mother who'd lain with dozens of druids from all over Great Britain during the course of a 3-day council, held in the tiny Welsh village of Cochlis, 1178 years ago, had risen high above the ignominy of his birth and was this close to becoming powerful beyond his wildest dreams, able to command even the legendary Tuatha De Danann themselves. His earliest years had not been easy. He'd struggled. He'd worked. He'd studied. He'd traveled the world seeking knowledge and power. He'd transformed himself from the bastard son of a whore other druids had refused to recognize, to a man respected and deeply feared by the mightiest among druids and sorcerers alike. It had been during those early years of travel that he'd learned of the Dark Hallows. He'd managed to secure rubbings from 3 sacred pages of the incredible Dark Book at the tender age of 28. He'd devoted the next 8 years of his life to deciphering the encrypted rubbings. Upon succeeding, he'd learned much from those rubbings, including the location of the Dark Glass of the Unseelie Fae, as well as the necessary tithing and the binding spells to use it. In exchange for the triple boon of the sacrifice of innocent blood, the ensorcelment of a captive, and a recurring tithe of pure gold, it bestowed eternal life. It was rumored that Merlin himself had once possessed the dark glass, until it had been seized from him by an army 1,000 strong and a mysterious group of Irish holy men. Unfortunately, knowing where it was and how to use it hadn't been enough. Lucan had tried 4 times to get to the dark glass, and 4 times he'd failed. The final time, he'd barely escaped with his life, and he'd been forced to concede that he simply didn't possess the power necessary to get past the Guardians. He'd spent the next 7 years of his life looking for someone who did. He'd found him in Cian McKelter. He'd hated the Highlander on first sight. Chapter 15. Jessica lay face down in a pool of blood, her glossy black curls wetly matted to her head. She was bled white, stiff and icy in death. Her spine was drawn in a painful bow. Her right leg splayed at an impossible angle. Her left arm was bent awkwardly over her head, the underside of the wrist down, the palm twisted gruesomely up. Her other hand was clenched in a bloody fist. It was obvious she'd suffered as she'd died. Not just pain. Horrific pain. She'd cried out for him. She'd never stopped believing he would save her. He'd told her that he would, that he would be her shield. He'd vowed to stand between her and all others. He'd failed. Pounding the wall with his fists, Cian tossed back his head and howled like an animal. The sound echoed from walls of stone, ricocheted off a stone ceiling, bounced back at him from a stone floor. 1,133 years had not driven him insane, but the past 2 days had managed to accomplish what 11 centuries had not. She was out there, his Jessica, with only her wits and will to rely upon, and he was trapped in the mirror, unable to protect her. From the moment the dark glass had reclaimed him, the terrible possibilities had begun playing themselves, with chilling detail, in never-ending repetition through his mind. An assassin had slipped onto the plane and into the seat behind them, then taken her captive the moment she disembarked. She was, even now, drugged and on her way to London. Nay, the bloody frigging plane had simply plummeted from the air, crashing thousands of miles to the ocean below, sinking like a stone. He didn't understand how the hell it stayed up there anyway. It might have wings, but they didn't flap. This was the kindest of his hells. She suffered no indignities, and death came more swiftly in this than any others. Nay, when his mirror was next uncovered, it would be to discover himself once again hung upon Lucan's study wall, staring down at his beautiful Jessica, tied and gagged, being raped and tortured by his ancient enemy. Nay, when his mirror was next uncovered, he would see only Lucan's hated face, and the bastard would do the same thing he'd done to him with word of Cian's mother and sisters. Never utter a word about Jessica again, no matter how Cian pleaded, leaving him to imagine the worst of all possibles every single day for the rest of his eternal existence. Each hellish possibility was worse than the last, slicing like a sword into his gut. Cian slumped down against the wall, hands fisted, jaw clenching, waiting, waiting.
"Aha! There you are!"
Jessie exclaimed brightly as she rounded the corner.
"Finally!"
12 yards away, at the end of the very last row, did it ever work any other way? With the words, "Unauthorized Entry," emblazoned in red across it, between a few dozen smaller stampings of the word, "Fragile," the tall plywood crate perched on end. She glanced anxiously at her watch. It had taken her forever to find him. She was afraid that any minute now Stoneface was going to come crashing through the doors behind her with half of Edinburgh's airport security in tow. When she'd first pushed through those double doors, she'd expected to find a small storehouse, not an industrial warehouse that stretched the length of a football field, with tiers that climbed all the way to a 40-foot ceiling, and row after row of numbered boxes, crates, and assorted packages. She'd wasted precious time searching aisles of numbered items before deducing that the unnumbered items, lacking tickets, were probably stored at the far end of the humongous building because the staff knew no one would be collecting them anytime soon.
The crate must have been the most recent arrival, as it was all the way down in the final spot at the end of the row. Sprinting toward it, she called out the summoning spell.
Leoth, Bri, Kebri, Kian McKelter, Drachmis, Eshi.
Nothing happened. She repeated the chant, expecting light to blaze from the cracks and the crate to begin rocking or something. Again nothing. Drawing to a breathless halt in front of it, she pressed her ear to the wood panel.
Kian?
She called. She glanced warily over her shoulder. Despite the vastness of the warehouse and her apparent solitude within it, she was nonetheless reluctant to make a commotion. Squaring her shoulders, she opted for something more than an exclamation, but less than a shout.
Kian!
She pressed her ear to the plywood again. Was that a muffled roar? She listened a moment. Sure sounded like it. Yep, there was another. She drew back and pounded on the crate with her fists.
Kian, I'm here. Can you hear me? Come on, get your butt out here now. We have to hurry. I don't know how long we have before they find us. Leoth, Bray, Kebray, Kian McKelter, Drachmi Seishi.
Total silence. Just when she'd begun to think something must have gone seriously wrong en route, or she had the wrong crate or something, brilliant light blazed from the cracks. The warehouse felt even larger than it was, and she heard the rustle of inner packing. A powerful fist splintered through the wood half an inch from her left ear. Blinking, Jesse scrambled back. He heard her, calling him. At first, Kian thought her voice was but another figment of his tortured imaginings. Then it snapped impatiently.
Get your butt out here now!
And he laughed aloud. She was his prickly Jessica. They'd made it to Scotland, and she was freeing him again. Pushing against masses of packing and cushion wrap, he shoved from the mirror and turned his body into a battering ram. He crashed a fist through the wood, then another, kicked and pounded at the crating with all the caged fury and impotent rage that had been riding him for 2 endless days. He demolished the front of the crate, ripping it to shreds with his bare hands. When he glanced up from the splinters, it was to find Jessica backed up flush to a shelving unit, staring at him, her face pale.
"Oh, Christ, woman,"
he hissed. Devouring the space between them in 2 strides, he cupped her jaw with 1 big hand, tipped her face up, and claimed her mouth in a kiss. Once, twice, 3 times. Then he drew back and glared down at her.
"I thought you were dead. I couldn't fucking get out of there, and I thought of 1,000 things I'd done wrong, and imagined 1,000,000 deaths for you. Kiss me, Jessica. Show me you're alive."
Jesse blinked up at Kian, stunned.
"Kiss me, Jessica."
His words hung in the air.
"Show me you're alive."
When he'd come crashing out of the crate, for a moment she genuinely thought he'd gone crazy, so stark and inhuman was the expression in his eyes. Then he'd turned a look on her that had scorched right through her clothing, her skin seared all the way to her bones, and before he'd even spoken, she'd known it had been fear for her that had put that wildness in him. She'd been stunned. She'd been secretly thrilled. Because although she'd been refusing to admit it, even to herself, the whole time she'd been sitting in the airport, trying to figure out a way to get to him, she'd been suppressing an ever-growing panic. And not just because he was her best chance of staying alive. Somehow, it had gotten personal. 1,000 worries had been plaguing her. Worries about him. Where was he? Was he okay? What if the mirror had inadvertently gotten broken? Would he die? Would he be stuck in there forever? What if Lucan had somehow gotten his hands on him? How would she find him? Would she have to hunt down this scary Lucan guy and steal Kian back? What if she never saw the towering, dark, infuriatingly barbaric, sexy Highlander again?
"It's just hormones. Combustive chemistry compounded by danger, nothing more."
Whatever it was, his reaction was playing right into a fantasy she'd not even known she'd been having. That when she found him, he would not merely stalk out of that mirror to save her.
he would stalk out of it to claim her, crush her against the steely, hard strength of his body, and take slick, velvety possession of her with his tongue. Give her the most base, elemental affirmation that he was alive, and she was alive, and they lived to fight another day. It was, she realized, how women throughout all of history must have felt each time their men returned from battle on their own 2 feet, not bound over the back of a horse, or piled dozens deep atop a wagon. Desperate for every morsel of passion life had to offer. Or at least for a few steamy kisses, anyway. Surely there was no harm in a few kisses. Famous final words, she would think later. She tipped her head back and wet her lips. He needed no further encouragement. Whiskey eyes glittering with lust, he cupped the back of her head with a big palm and slanted his mouth over hers. The moment their lips met this time, heat lightning crackled between them and they both went wild.